too horrible. It's beyond everything. Nothing at all that I know touches it. For dreadful, dreadfulness. For general uncanny ugliness and horror and pain.
I'm damned to eternal hell for my sins.
I am one of the Legion.
Behind us now, Ratatat from 2008, LP3, a track called Bird Priest. We finished the set in today's program with music from Pink Playground, Destination Ecstasy, the name of the LP, from which we heard Dark Bloom, Silk Flowers Before That, Days of Arrest, the name of the LP, we heard Out in Front. Casio Kids, CD entitled Abenbaringen over Askamen, and we heard a song called Selskapets Truste of Slutning. Trent Mahler before that from Reworked Remix, the track called Even Though You're With Another Girl, I Blame Coco version. Jean-Philippe Goude from 1980, CD called Drones, the track Machine. Popol Vuh, the previously unreleased track called Kalash, Last Village, now collected on this double CD called Revisited and Remixed, 1970 to 1999. The Miranda Sex Garden before that, covering the Eraserhead track In Heaven, the Lady in the Radiator's song, from their CD called Suspiria. We open that set with Francis Daumont, his Frankenstein Symphony, an excerpt from the Allegro movement. That's everything we heard. Hey, happy Halloween to you. My name's Scott. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to everybody who came to the record fair and volunteered at the record fair. Thanks to everybody who put me over the top with that little secret fundraiser we've been doing. And good night to you. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is next. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org. The following names are from the Book of the Blessed. It's Christine Luftgen, Richard Cleaves, Gabriel Walsh, Michael Tapp, Alex Christofak, Dan Pfeiffer, Noah Mayers, Patrick Keegan, Andrew Correll, Stephen Baldi, Rob Wojciech, Craig Simonson, Dimitri Erkin, Bob Downing, Eugene R. Reynolds, Dan Porup, Jason Siegel, Michael Fredericks, Joel Butler, Ann Callahan, Joe Monzel, Mark Ramsayer, Elliot Karum, Gregory Walker, James White, and Jeff Moore. Thanks to every single one of you and everyone else who's supported the WFMU Shock in October Silent Marathon.
Is it real radio or internet radio?
Andrew Keen is the author of the infamous 2007 screed Cult of the Amateur. And while he's still obviously a hater of internet content, he's got his eye on a new target. In the March issue of Wired UK, he takes on the cult of sharing.
On the internet now, every new business is really driven by social principles. With each new newsflash about Groupon and Twitter and Facebook and Foursquare, with the development of social television, social commerce, social productivity, it became clearer and clearer to me that we were in the grip of a new kind of mania. I'm not sure whether we want to call it the social moment or the social epoch or whatever else, but it is new. It is fundamentally new. It represents the shift from a Google-centric internet defined by a network of data to a Facebook-centric internet defined by a network of people. And more people are coming to that realization that something very profound is happening, something very profound is changing. So I'm not alone in understanding this. I think where I may be more alone is my critique. I think many people embrace it. There are what I would call social ideologists, particularly in Silicon Valley, who argue that we are by nature social animals, but I don't think we are. And of course, when they argue that, they're also self-interested, because the more they can convince us we're social, the more money they make. But there are many other people who are promoting this idea of the social and see in the internet the solution to many of the traditional problems, particularly in America, with its obsession with community and collectivity and the crisis of individualism and loneliness and alienation and all those other things. I don't think these people are bad. I think they mean well. But I think they're wrong. I think they misunderstand the nature of man. I think they're wrong to argue that we are by nature social beings. I think the problem is that we're not really understanding what we're getting involved with here. We're slipping and sliding into something that it that no one's really architecting. There's no evil person at the heart of this. Mark Zuckerberg is a child, very rich child, but I don't think he's an evil person. Most of the people who are promoting and developing geo-tagging services and geolocation services, they're not evil either. But when you add Facebook and Twitter to geolocation and to social gaming and to social television and to social commerce, and given that we're increasingly living on the network, the more this social revolution progresses, the more inevitably, like it or not, we're revealing ourselves to the world. So it's this slippery slope into something that it's not going back to East Germany or the Stasi. It's not 1984. It's not Brave New World. It's something different. We are collectively embracing the idea of the social without really quite understanding where it's going to lead.
So in your essay, which is clearly an outline for what's going to be your next book, you bring up the specter of the Panopticon, the prison that the philosopher Jeremy Bentham designed in 1785, a prison that enabled constant surveillance. So are you saying that by sharing, we're creating a prison for ourselves?
I use Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon in my narrative, partially because it's a very striking, sexy idea, partly because I think it's relevant, not because we are recreating the Panopticon, but because firstly, we've reached a decisive moment in the digital revolution in the same way as I think the Panopticon represented a kind of decisive moment in the evolution of the Industrial Revolution. Secondly, though, I think it's worth noting that the Panopticon wasn't invented by an evil man. Bentham was a good man, a social reformer. He meant well for humanity. He wasn't the Stasi. He wasn't an East German secret policeman. He wasn't evil. He didn't get pleasure out of humiliating people. He believed that surveillance would improve the human condition. He believed that surveillance would result in a world in which we were more efficient and happier. I think Zuckerberg really says the same thing. There's a very strong streak of utilitarianism in Zuckerberg, and the social utopians are also saying the same thing. They're not suggesting we recreate the Panopticon, but their idea of utility isn't that different from Bentham. Now, I'm not a Luddite, and I'm not a technological determinist. I don't believe that we can't control the technology we've invented. And in fact, I think when we look back at the 19th century, when we look back at the Industrial Revolution, we would see a similar moment in the middle of the 19th century. The Industrial Revolution was changing everything, and the Industrial Revolution was, in a sense, inevitable, but not everything about it was inevitable. It needed to be controlled, and the consequences on individual freedom, on privacy, on secrecy, were immense. And so you had a series of 19th century thinkers, John Stuart Mill, a number of Americans, Louis Brandeis, who defended the right of the individual to privacy and secrecy in the industrial age. And we have to do the same in the digital age. It doesn't mean we have to trash our computers. It doesn't mean we have to turn off the internet. I'm not in favor of that, even if we could, and we can't. The challenge we have is retaining our humanity. And I think much of our humanity is predicated on secrecy and privacy, maintaining that privacy and secrecy, that essential humanness in the digital age. And the purpose of my book is to warn the human race, everyone who's listening, the millions of people who are listening to this wonderful radio station. I'm warning you, don't fall in love with this thing, because it's going to result in an awful ending. It's going to make you all very unhappy. Maintain your privacy and your secrecy. Cherish that. Do not fall in love with the idea of transparency, because it's a bad woman and will lead to heartbreak and deep unhappiness.
There's your Facebook. Okay. There's your LinkedIn. There's your Twitter.
Oh, man.
There's your MySpace.
Oh, no. I thought I deleted it.
Nope. And this is even in the cache.
Oh, man.
Do you see what this is?
There's embarrassing photos with scantily clad women.
Very sexy. I see two ladies dressed as nurses. One of them is maybe trying to lick your face. Good thing you got the nurses because you're one sick dude.
I thought this is all gone.
Okay. You're so easy to find stuff. This is like a piece of cake.
Ada Calhoun isn't exactly a private eye. She's a writer. But when her self-taught internet sleuthing skills caught the attention of her bosses at the New York City tabloid she worked at, they put her to work.
I kind of became a sort of go-to person to find things out about people on the internet. And I discovered how easy it is to get a lot of information very quickly about pretty much anybody, even people you wouldn't necessarily think were online. You know, I was in the newsroom when the Times Square bombing happened. And I was on the MySpace page of his brother-in-law. Up popped this beautiful picture of the Times Square bomber's wedding, captioned, "My sis and bro-in-law." That was a huge get for us.
And did you end up using that photo?
We did, and then it was actually in the Times 2 days later and on CNN and everywhere else. It feels a little creepy going through people's photo albums. Mm. One other example is I was told to find out anything I could about the porn star Capri Anderson, who was found hiding in Charlie Sheen's bathroom because he's on this, you know, drug-fueled rage. So I found, you know, various aliases. She has like a lot of different porn sites with different names, and then I found her real name. And then I was going through all of her family's pages, her, you know, pictures of her father. Pictures of her cousins, things like that. And then I started finding all these photos of her as she was growing up, things people had posted. And again, they'd taken steps not to expose her identity. She was not tagged in the pictures. I just recognized her because I knew what she looked like. But again, untagged. So you could never find her unless you know her family's names and you like, and one person, it just takes one person who you know who doesn't have their photo set to private or who has their photo set to private but posts one on their wall, which lets you circumvent the privacy rules of Facebook.
Ada Calhoun recently wrote an essay about her sleuthing experiences for Salon. And while she says we can't really do anything about the unflattering photos our friends and family are posting, there are some things we can do. Right now, find an online photo of yourself that you like and give it this title. Media, please use this photo if I'm hit by a bus.
After I started the job, very quickly, I got my, you know, if I get hit by a bus picture in line and publicly available, and then I deleted all my friends that I didn't know on Facebook. I was like, because, you know, for a while I was just like, oh, sure, whatever, like, maybe they read my book, maybe, but I don't care. No, you know, why would it matter? But actually, it's like you kind of, you know, if somebody's coming in there and looking like, oh, they're friends with this person, like, it does reflect on you in this way. There are certain people that I wouldn't necessarily want a reporter calling, you know, after my demise for information about me. So I deleted them all. I deleted comments off my page. Again, like, you know, maybe you want to delete the sexy nurses, that picture and the comments attached to it. Maybe try to get people to post things about, like, work with orphans that you've done, you know? Something that's a little more flattering.
Yeah, but, you know, I actually have a friend who was sadly hit by a car in Manhattan last year, and pictures of her ended up all over. You know, she was in the New York Times and everything. And I couldn't help but wondering, like, is that really the picture she would want people to use?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because I think they just kind of grabbed it off of Facebook.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, yeah, deleting anything you definitely don't want out there is first line of defense.
As more and more of our lives get shared and lived online, though, the delete button isn't really an option. And what are you going to do if you lose control of your online self? What are you going to do when your digital self starts running amok? When the New Jersey college student Tyler Clementi discovered his roommate had filmed him making out with another boy and posted it online, he decided to delete himself. Ada Calhoun was working in the newsroom when this story broke, and she believes it's a warning for all of us.
What made that story so sad to me, I think, was like he even went online after he was, allegedly filmed by his roommate. He went online and asked what he should do about it. Like, he went in this gay chat room that he was part of and said, what do I do? And he got pretty good advice, you know, overall. Talk to the RA, talk to the school, get a transfer, all these kind of things. And I think he tried to do it, and it just didn't really work out. And so he posted on Facebook, sorry, jumping off the George Washington Bridge. And then he did it. And I think for him, he seemed to have invested so much of his life online. I mean, just judging from what I talked to friends about, he was living a lot of his life online. He actually had been going online since he was in fifth grade. And he was in message boards constantly. He was very chatty, very funny. And he started, I think he must have been 13 or something, asking about his pet hermit crabs and talking about them. And, asking advice on Yahoo Answers or something. And he used the same username for, 10 years or however long. And I think as soon as the internet betrayed him in the way that it did, which was pretty savage, I think it seemed like the end of the world. I think when you invest so much of your life into the internet and into how you're portrayed and into your relationships, you're sort of quasi-real relationships online, eventually you realize that they're not real and that actually you don't really know these people and they don't really know you. And the information that's out there can change in a second. You can spend all this time building up, these huge photo galleries of pictures of you, having this wonderful time or whatever it is that you want people to see. And the second somebody posts something that captures people's imagination more than what you've put up, that's going to be the story. That's it. That's it forever.
There's now a generation that's grown up completely online. Academics like to call this generation digital natives.
Kids who were born right around the time that pretty much everyone got an email address. So kids who had really grown up in the internet age and didn't really know anything different. The interesting thing to me is that these kids are right now, the kids who are sort of the first real digital natives are at the age where they're starting to have romantic entanglements and young love.
Alex Morris is a writer for New York Magazine, and for her recent essay, They Know What Boys Want, she spent a few months hanging out with teenage girls to learn what it's like to sexually awaken in the digital age.
So when I was 12, I got what I would call my first real boyfriend, in that we went on semi-dates where our parents would drive us to the movies, drop us off, let us watch a PG movie together alone, and then pick us up an hour and 45 minutes later and take us home. And this was considered a date, and you would be in the theater and you'd hold hands and you might smooch, and it was all very exciting. And in terms of what's happening now, one of the girls I talked to who was 12 had a boyfriend who was in her grade at school, and she said that she really didn't talk to him in real life, that she got very nervous around him and was uncomfortable with that. And that really where, and so I was like, well, then how are you, do you go on dates? Or how do you say you're dating? And she was like, well, we date over IM. And she said that that was great for her because it's so much easier for her to express herself if she's not having to do so face to face.
It's like it's easier for them.
Yeah, in terms of how the internet kind of takes away that awkward fumbling of young love. But I do think that a lot of these girls felt like the guys were more sort of brash online than they would ever, ever have the nerve to be face to face. And also, and this is not just with them saying, send naked photographs, do this thing with me that I saw online, which was certainly happening. But it also was when it came to them being honest about what the relationship was. And there was a sense among the girls that guys could, very quickly over IM jot off, I love you. And it wasn't really, it's not really clear if they mean it when it's coming over the internet. And a lot of the girls told me, oh, a guy would never say that to your face, but they'll write it to you, or they'll, so there is a sense that the guys are, in some cases I think it's true. The guys mean it when they say it, and the girls believe that, or the ones I talk to believe that as well. But they also have a sense that it's very easy to just sort of say what you think someone wants to hear when you're just typing it over IM,
Now, teenage girls have always had to deal with the veracity of I love you notes. like since the beginning of time. But what Alex Morris says is different now is what these girls are expected to do in order to get any online validation.
I ran into some sixth graders who were very agitated. There were three of them, because another girl that they had been friends with, and she had sort of been cut out because of this, had been sending topless pictures around to the boys at school. The girls that I met were very upset about this because they felt pretty much betrayed by this girl, in that they understood that that was against the rules, that you're not supposed to send around pictures like that. And they felt that in doing so, this girl had put herself at an advantage over them with the guys. You know, they mentioned how now all the girls are going to hate her, but all the boys are going to love her. She's getting all the attention from the guys now. If she cries, all the guys rush over and they're like, oh, what's wrong? What's wrong? I mean, they had a real sense that this affected her, her standing with the boys in their grade. And they understand if you put something out there, it can spread, it can get beyond your control. It is not a good idea. But there is pressure to be doing these things that they understand are dangerous. They know that the stakes are raised. I think that they are disappointed that they can't, that the, you know, they can't sort of feel like they're easing into things, that it's, you know, there's such graphic imagery. The boys have become so immune to so many things that in order to get attention, I think they do feel like they're potentially going to have to do things that they are uncomfortable with. This goes without saying, but it is sort of sad that we live in a culture where girls need to feel that kind of validation at all. And hopefully, you know, you obviously want girls to recognize and want other types of validation as well. But I do think it's important at that age to feel like you are appealing. I think to say otherwise would be to just lie. I think it's probably important at most ages. But certainly at that time when you're just sort of awakening to your sexuality. And so if I were 12 or 13 years old right now, I think that I would feel very pressured to put sexy pictures online. Maybe not pictures that expose anything, but I think that there would be a great pressure to do that. In the same way that when I was growing up, there was pressure to, like, wear a push-up bra. You know? And since I did that, I think it's safe to say that I would feel pressured to put my sexuality online in some capacity. I think pretty much everyone feels pressure to do that now.
I would say in history, you know, you had all this discussion about the soul and the body and the language. And in our secular world, we have forgotten about the soul, but we have recreated maybe an electronic soul.
Dieter Bigo is one of the scientific coordinators of the European Project for Liberty and Security. He's trying to work out the big problem of balancing security, surveillance, and privacy on an international scale. He also spends a lot of time thinking about our digital selves. He calls them our data doubles.
People don't realize that when they give their data, the data between the different bureaucracy, what I call the data double, is not them. It's piece of information which have been frozen. They are perfect information, very precise. But one day, 25 years ago, plus one day, 12 years old, plus one day, and they are fried together as if it was you. It's not. Of course, it's part of you. The details are precise. The overall picture is completely wrong. So that's the first element about your data double. It's a concentration about you, but it's not you. To give an example, you are born before the independence of many states in the south of the Mediterranean. And so you were the son of the daughter of a colonial occupation. Now it says that you are born in Beirut. And because you are born in Beirut, you will be put on the same category that other people who have been born in Beirut. The logic has nothing to do with you, your life. It will be with a certain category of danger, or even not danger. It could be dangerous people, but it could be just people undesirable. This data double is part of a category of other data double. And very often through the logic of profiling, you are aggregated with others. So my idea is that the data double has his own life, his own travel. He's mixing with people you have never met. For example, you have your data double travel nearby another data double on the plane. But what if this other guy, this other data double, is associated himself with, wrongly, with a terrorist name? You are associated with him. So this logic of association is completely transformed by who is traveling with whom. The point of the story is that if you travel, for example, the data double is like your guardian angel. He is sent before you, and if he is clean, you're clean. But if he's not clean, you're not clean. So you're blocked at the border, not because of, about your own life, but about the travel of your data double in a database where you don't have any form of control. More important also, very often, the data double is the truth about you. And so when you try to explain, I am who I am, and you speak, what is the relation to the bureaucracy? They don't believe you. They look at the data double. They look at your body. And they connect your fingerprints with your data double. And if you try to have a narrative about your own identity, it doesn't matter. So your data double is more real for the bureaucracy than you are. So we can imagine a world, it could be like a science fiction world, where they are so obsessed with your data doubles and they forget you. Maybe if you have traveled to London Heathrow Airport, Terminal 5, you will see that they look at you once for the camera, and after, they don't look at you at all. They only look at your paper. Try once to just change the paper with another, with your wife, or, and you will see that they don't look at you. They only look if the paper is okay. So it's an obsession about the paper, the registration, and the biometrics, and your own life is unimportant. It's absolutely central that people realize that this exchange of data through bureaucracy, through their data doubles, is affecting their lives, but in a way they cannot control.
Interesting to take this genre, the gadget blog, and do something great with it, and do something really individual and very different.
A couple of months ago, writer Matthew Battles got an email from the publisher of the gadget blog GearFuse, out of the blue, basically offering to pay him to do what he likes to do and what he's good at, write smart and interesting things about technology and culture.
So he pitched me basically a job where I would be the editor and lead writer at GearFuse. He said, you know, we've been working as a kind of content mill gadget blog for a long time, where we write these short items about sort of goofy tech gadgets of one kind or another, and rely on search engine optimization to get a lot of traffic. And I'd like to take the site in a different direction. And so I'm coming to you because I'd like the site to be professional. I'd like its content to be richer. I'd like it to be more in the vein of a Wired or an Atlantic Monthly technology channel. So I said yes and jumped in immediately. I would write 8 or 9 posts a day, and those posts covered a kind of spectrum of what GearFuse had from the start said was its brief: science, technology, and culture. My take on technology is, and I'm not utterly unique in this by any means, but my sensibility is a kind of historical one as well as anthropological. I'm interested in looking at the way in which we engage with changes in technology and how what we're experiencing now is both similar from and departs from things that people have experienced in the past. I'm also interested in a kind of associative, free associative, loosely psychoanalytic approach to gadgets, and what is it that we want these things to do, and what is it that we think we're doing, and what is it that we're actually doing with them when we try using them? What kind of buried dreams and hopes, what kind of utopian fantasies do our gadgets reveal about us? Everybody kind of understands that any kind of tool is like an extension of our senses or our body. And they're extensions of our psyches as well. So an interest in the kind of psychic manifestations of the technium, of the technological realm. You know, I was trying overall to build something that was greater than the sum of its parts. I mean, sort of build a kind of coherent vision out of all of these kind of renegade fantasies of science and technology, trying to build something that was kind of like a symphony of different perspectives, of different experiences of science and technology. Bruce Sterling writes about blogging that it's not about the writing, it's about the blogging. And what he means is that you build over time, if a blog is to work as a kind of intellectual and creative venture, you build over time a kind of resonating experience that and that's what readers come for, rather than coming for a kind of individual posts. They're tuning into a channel. They want to hear a certain frequency and a certain kind of, they want to taste a certain kind of flavor. And so for me, you know, creating that palette was what was the creative excitement of working on GearFuse.
Of course, this business deal turned out to be too good to be true. Matthew Battles didn't even get the 6 months the publisher had promised him.
So after about 2 months, I got an email from the publisher. This was really totally out of the blue. He tells me he's lost an ad deal that he had counted on to make the next few months viable at GearFuse, and he was going to have to shut me down, effective immediately, actually. And that was sort of it, full stop. He was nice. He was complimentary of the work that I'd done and expressed his desire to go forward, his wish that he could go forward with it, but said that it wouldn't be possible to do any longer. And so I wrote back and said, you know, that is terrible news. It's a real problem for me. And it was a problem not only because I was relying on the money, but because, you know, I'd really begun to get into the rhythm and get into the work. So a lot of plans immediately went up in smoke. And so the end game, and I wrote a short post saying, this is my last post at GearFuse. I've enjoyed my time here. I'm not sure what happens next for the site. I haven't been told. But I hope things continue well, something like that. It was a very short post, mentioning none of my disappointment, casting no blame or for that matter, not making any explanation for what had happened. And the publisher then followed that later that night with a post of his own, in which he basically said that it was a lot of fun to watch what Matthew was doing here, but it didn't work. His titles were too long, and too often had, you know, SART quotes in them. This was a charge that he made, and the traffic was failing to keep up with what I needed. He called my approach too highbrow, and then said, you know, you readers, you need your tech ids scratched. That's a quote from that post. You basically saying you haven't been well served by this highbrow take on technology, and I want to give you the kind of brain candy that I know you really want. And so, you know, in that post, he basically blamed whatever failure took place on me. When I read that post, I was absolutely shocked. I read it on Saturday morning, and I was about to go out with my family, and I felt like I was going to pass out. I felt like here he is, basically painting a target on me. I'm somebody who's trying to make my living doing this kind of work, and for a post to be out there, you know, Googleable and accessible by any prospective editor or employer, that's basically saying this guy kills traffic. I felt like a target had been painted on me.
I see this profile this girl has uploaded, and she's like, I'm going to be in Chicago for a couple of nights, and you know, want to go to bed with someone. And she like looks hot, and I'm like, what the hell, I've never done anything like this before. So I message her, and she messages me back, and like I end up meeting her at the bar in the hotel, and we go up, and yeah.
So where did you find this woman?
On OkCupid.
Ah. Okay, continue.
So I say to her, it's weird because this is simultaneously the most intimate experience you'll have and the least intimate experience you'll have. And she's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, you know, obviously, like, we're never going to see each other again, and so that's not that intimate. But at the same time, she's like completely not a part of my normal life, my day-to-day life. Like, we have no mutual friends, just nothing in common. And so I can tell her anything, you know, and she can tell me anything, and it won't affect her in the least. And she says, well, it's funny you mention that, because I have a secret that I haven't told anyone else. And I asked her if I could record it.
So she doesn't know you, and she has a secret.
She knows that I work in radio, or I do like radio stuff.
So she knows you're more than just like some podcaster.
Yes.
So she let you record this secret.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
what was it?
Well, you have to tune into my radio show.
What do you mean? You're not going to tell me?
No, of course not. This is radio gold, man.
Good God. So this is what your life is like now? You just hook up with random people on OkCupid to do work?
No. That was sort of a unique circumstance. The rest of them have been sort of more traditional dates, I guess.
Uh-huh. And are you doing this a lot?
Yeah.
Like, how often?
I don't know. Last week I went on 5 different dates.
So you decided to bang like all of Chicago in your spare time now, Nick?
Yes.
And what is so great about OkCupid compared to like ScrewMe.com?
So for example, when I first started, this girl, well, I guess scrolling through different profiles of different people, she like basically like favorited me. And when you do that, it sends the other person a message. So I get an email that says, like, so-and-so has favorited you.
This is just like primates in a freaking schoolyard.
But it's like, it's actually, it's kind of nice because it's like you, you can immediately get rid of just like a lot of people who would not be good potential partners, you know? If you go up to someone at a bar, you don't know anything about them, you know? You don't know, like, what's...
Yeah, but I've never gone up to a girl at a bar and said, hey, I just favorited you. You'll get an email when you go to the bathroom.
Anyway, so I go to this girl's profile, and she's really cute. I mean, she seems super wild. Her makeup is, like, all crazy, weird, like, all over her face. She's, like, clearly some sort of arty type person. And I'm like, okay, you know, I think I get a good read for this girl. So I message her, and I say, like, no introductions, like, nothing. And keep in mind, like, she's already expressed an interest in me. She's seen my profile. She thinks I'm cool or whatever, or potentially cool. And I message her, and I go, let's do something dangerous. And she goes immediately, is like, absolutely, what do you have in mind? And I'm like, shit, I didn't think this far through. So I'm like, okay, well, I just passed by this, like, abandoned factory in Chicago, and it's, like, these crazy big silos and everything. And this had happened, like, the night before, so I'm like, let's go break into this abandoned building together. And she's like, okay, great. And I'm like, cool, I'll send you more details later. And then I sign off and I just disappear. So I'm like playing it super cool, right?
Oh yeah, super cool. First thing that came to my mind.
So the weird thing is, like, the night before, I had met this girl at a bar and had given her my number.
Like an actual girl at an actual bar.
Yeah, like flesh and blood. Like,
you didn't favor her.
No, I like went up to her. She was with a group and sat down, chatted with her, and then I had to run off, just, like, handed my number, right? And Erica, I'm not going to use your real name.
Kathy.
No, I don't like the name. Amy has texted me and is like, hey, let's hang out. So that night, I go to this dinner party where Amy's going to be at, and I show up before her. It's like a sort of a big party or whatever. It was, you know. And I see an acquaintance of mine, this girl, Rachel, who's like a friend of a friend who we've met a couple times before. And so I say hi. I mean, she's like the only person I know at this party. So I sit down and we're chatting. And she's like, so I hear that you met Amy. And I was like, yeah. And she's like, yeah, that's my roommate. You know, she's been talking about, like, this cute guy who hit on her. And I'm like, oh, that's crazy. Like, they're roommates, you know, whatever. So then I start, like, getting a little bit more information about her, like, getting a little bit of background so I can go into it, you know, prepared. And so we're hanging out, we're chatting, and this other girl walks into the room, and she obviously knows this girl, Rachel, and, like, waves at her and comes over and sits down with us. And Rachel's like, oh, hey, this is my friend Liz. This is my roommate. My other roommate, you know, she's pretty hot, and I introduce myself, and she goes, actually, we've already met. And the moment she said that, I was like, oh man, you are the girl from OKCupid that I was going to break into the abandoned building with the next day.
Oh, good God.
And then as, like, I mean, like, everything's, like, sort of going in slow motion now, and I'm, like, kind of working this out in my brain, and I look over at Rachel, and I can sort of see the gears sort of turning in her mind. And just as I, like, figure out what's going on, then Amy walks into the room, and she sits down. And then it's just, like, super awkward. And I think I didn't really know what else to say, so I just go... I turn to Rachel and go, do you have any other roommates who I can hit on? And Rachel laughs, and the other two girls don't really realize what's going on. And so they don't laugh. you know, what's
is that your phone?
Yeah, I'm gonna turn it off.
Is that an Android noise?
It's one of the noise the Android makes.
What was that a sign of?
That was a sign that I have an email.
Like from OK Cupid?
Yes.
No, seriously, do you use your phone to work with OKCupid?
There is an Android app for OKCupid.
And you use it?
But I'm trying to quit because it's just getting really distracting because I'm getting a message like every day with a girl who wants to hang out with me.
Presented by its producer through the facilities of Manhattan Cable Television, in accordance with government regulations. We are not responsible for the content of this program, and its transmission does not imply our approval.
Long before people started sharing their most intimate secrets and desires on the internet, there was something called local cable public access television. And this is where anything and everything could happen.
These public access personalities, or these public access stars, if you may, just really, really expressed their true feelings and what they wanted to express over the media that couldn't be expressed on mainstream TV.
In 1979, a 9-year-old Joel Gutenberg discovered the Manhattan Public Access Channel on his cable set, and he was instantly hooked.
YouTube couldn't really capture seeing this live on TV, people really expressing their emotions or expressing their feelings. And it can go beyond, humor. It can be or politics. It could be sex or real pornography. Just actually seeing it on your TV just really captured a full essence, a full flair of it, of you actually experiencing it in it actually live in person, or about as close as you could experience it to you doing it yourself.
I met Joel Gutenberg at the Museum of the Moving Image last weekend. We were both there to check out TV Party, a new exhibition celebrating the storied and colorful history of New York City public access television.
Oh, yeah.
For the next 2 weeks, the museum will be screening archival footage featuring many of the folks who transfixed viewers like young Joel Gutenberg.
Hi, welcome to the Scott and Gary Show. As you can see from the hearts, this is our Valentine's Day show, so we have one of the most romantic bands in New York City with us, the Beastie Boys.
You can see segments from the Scott and Gary Show, Coco Crystal's If I Can't Dance, Then You Can Keep Your Revolution.
Thank you. Here I am tonight, January 5th, 1983, and I've got a special show.
And the live show.
For you.
The program is guest curated by Nicholas Rapold and Leah Cherner. She told me that even though these shows are decades old, they still retain their vibrancy and relevance.
There's something really appealing about those, about watching recordings of those old live shows, even though it's like they were never meant to be seen again, but they're still just really fascinating because there's something about them that feels less dated than watching like a sitcom from 1982.
Opening night was billed as a reunion. And after the screening, many of the stars took the stage. William Hohauser from The Volk Show, Lisa Yap, and Michael Concepcion was there wearing his full-body Rapid T Rabbit costume. I was very excited to meet Jaime Davidovich, who is still active in the video art scene today. But he didn't like my YouTube comparison because, as he sees it, not just anyone could do public access TV.
To do a public access show, no matter how raw the show is, how primitive it is, it has to have some type of preparation because it's a 30-minute show. So even if you have no talent and you have a big ego and you go there and you prove yourself, you still have to be in front of a camera 30 minutes. And in YouTube, you can do it, a baby crying for 20 seconds and could be a big hit.
Who's the guy in the shades? Is that Chris Stein?
A lot of work goes into this. And I used to get
very sensitive when people said, oh, that was terrible. That was a waste of time. I can't believe you even doing that or spending your money. I had a vision that that's what I like to do. Basically, I wanted to do a show that I would like to watch.
Scott Lewis was the host of The Scott and Gary Show. And like Jaime Davidovich, he put a lot of work into his live show. Lewis did live comedy, and he hosted bands like the Butthole Surfers and Half Japanese. And while MTV was cool with ripping off his set design for remote control, they wouldn't even give him a PA job. He told me real TV just couldn't understand public access at all.
I met at a wedding a guy who was a producer, director for CBS, and told him about my show. He said, oh, I'd love to see it. So I go up to his office, great studio, great office, have my tapes. And as we were, you know, playing these tapes, including Stevie Moore and all these other cool bands, he said to me after, this is what we can do. We'll package your show as the worst bands in America. And I'm like, no, these aren't the worst. I'm sitting there, and the guy's looking at me, well, package this as the worst bands in America. Great idea for a show. I'm like, no, that's not a great idea for a show. That's not my show. You know, I don't think you quite understand. These are actually pretty cool bands, and people do like it.
20 years later, it seems that some folks still don't get it. George Stoney is considered one of the grandfathers of public access television, and he was also in attendance. But when he took the stage, he railed at the curators, accusing them of celebrating the absolute worst of public access. I asked him afterwards why he was so angry.
The kind of trivial, tasteless material that we saw tonight. I'm not saying that people don't have the right to waste their time. They have a right to make themselves ridiculous. But that's not what I'm fighting for.
It seemed like you were a little upset. At first I thought it was because you were sitting next to a man in a rabbit suit, but it seemed like you were angry about something else.
No, the person in the rabbit suit represents the kind of triviality that this panel represented.
What was missing for you tonight?
All the community programs, all the things that cause people to not only watch television, but get something from it.
Welcome to the Wild Record Collection with me, your host, Snuffles! That's right, it's the show!
It's really sad that George Stoney is so angry about the show at the Museum of the Moving Image, because a lot of the material being celebrated is material which has gone to inspire other citizens to take up the tools of production and make their own TV, which is the whole point of this community affair. This is what I learned from Tony Arena and Ron Grunwald, who hosts The Wild Record Party, a program that's still airing on public access. If you've never seen this program before, you need to go to YouTube immediately and check it out.
That's right, it's the show where we like to show you record covers like so, and play you cuts from those records like so, and have an awful lot of fun like so, and dance around a lot, woo!
I love doing it. It's my artistic outlet. I have a speech and drama degree, and I don't do any of that anymore at all. And it kind of lets me let off a little bit of steam through the character of Snuffles, who's much nicer than I am. He's very much like me, but he's much, much nicer.
Can I ask him something real
quick?
You can. I can?
You can.
Watching any of the lot of, thank you. Watching a lot of the stuff tonight, did you feel connected to that? That like you guys were like sort of carrying on a torch of like this kind of fun, or not even. I don't want to put words in your mouth. Did you feel like connected to like some of this older stuff you saw today?
Oh, absolutely. We really, really do. A lot of it was about music that you saw, and about freedom and expressing yourself and having a really, really good time. And that's what we really like. And in fact, we told Rabbit T. Rabbit that he was one of our biggest influences, and he really, really was. We used to watch that show and said, "How nutty! How crazy! And it really looks like a lot of work goes into it." And we'd like to be able to do that sometime, and we did.
Mm-hmm.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Free to Behave Like a Fool or a Machine. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen and Laura Mayer. It featured Andrew Keen, Ada Calhoun, Alex Morris, Dieter Bigo, Matthew Battles, Nick Vanderkolk, and everyone I spoke to at the public access show at the Museum of the Moving Image. There's more information on the WFMU playlist page at WFMU.org, and that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast as well.
Join us at the same time next week for another edition of Too Much Information. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up now, For the Record, with Dave Emery.
Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 333, titled Forward into the Past, subtitled Connecting the Dots, Part 6. This is being recorded on October 28th of 2001 and is another broadcast dealing with the terrible subject of the terrorist blitzkrieg of 9/11/2001. As I've said in other programs about that subject, I believe that the executive authority in this act was what I call the Underground Reich, embracing powerful elements in our country and in the Middle East. And by way of illustrating what I believe was involved at the operational arm, or as the operational arm of this attack by the Underground Reich on the United States, we're going to take a look at some past intelligence relationships between elements of U.S. intelligence and terrorist elements connected to not only the Underground Reich, but the Third Reich in its overground phase. And this is by way of illustrating the type of relationship that I believed doubled on the, I believe doubled on the United States in 9/11/2001. And, of course, as I've indicated in the past, there are strong connections between these types of elements and the Bush administrations and powerful elements in this country. The following is from the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, September 18th of 2001. This is an article by David Ignatius of the Washington Post, formerly of the Wall Street Journal, and this is a discussion of our need to recruit terrorists as informants for the intelligence community, and in fact, this is the type of relationship that I believe was exploited by the Underground Reich to double on the United States. The San Jose Mercury News titled this, Good Spies Need Help from the Bad Guys. And this deals with Ali Hassan Salame, the alleged mastermind of the Olympics massacre of 1972, who, as we looked at in RFA 22, was an informant for the CIA. Ignatius writes, What the CIA did back then was to open a secret channel with the PLO's chief of intelligence, a charismatic operative named Ali Hassan Salame. At that time, Palestinian terrorism against the United States was a serious threat, as vitriolic, if not as deadly, as Osama bin Laden is today. When these secret contacts began in 1970, they had the explicit approval of Yasser Arafat himself. But the relationship evolved and expanded over the years, and Salame came to be regarded within the CIA as a witting asset, uncontrolled and unpaid, but immensely valuable. Skipping down. Make no mistake, Salame, the CIA's contact, was a terrorist himself. He had been a key operative in Arafat's covert Black September organization, and the Israelis believe he helped plan the massacre of Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics in 1972. They even targeted Salame for assassination. To gather information about terrorism, in other words, the CIA was prepared to sup with the devil. Even after Munich, the CIA worked to maintain its intelligence link to Salame. Well, what we're going to do now is to go forward into the past. We're going to listen to an excerpt from RFA 22, recorded on July 8th of 1986. And in turn, we're going to hear a reference to an article by this very same David Ignatius from the Wall Street Journal of February 10th of 1983. Now, note the heritage here. Salame, who worked as a CIA asset, was the mastermind of the Olympics massacre of 1972. He, in turn, was the son of Hassan Salame, a key operative on behalf of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, a major in the SS, and a key player in the underground Reich. And we're going to hear that relationship discussed in the excerpt you're about to hear. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. This, again, from RFA 22, July 8, 1986. And, in fact, it was even more than just a friendship. Hassan Salameh was one of the most loyal lieutenants of Haj Amin al-Husseini, both while he was working for the Third Reich, and, again, as Nip indicated, Haj Amin al-Husseini was working with the so-called outside Turks that we reviewed in Radio Free America number 14 about the World Anti-Communist League. We also went into it at considerable length in Radio Free America number 21, the last of our shows about the Pope shooting, if people would like to read up more about that. Hassan Salameh, again, is one of the close assistants, one of the key, not only a good friend, but one of the key aides of Haj Amin al-Husseini during World War II. We'll take a look at their post-war association in a couple of minutes. But again, Haj Amin al-Husseini is the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the spiritual leader of all Palestinian Muslims. He also was a major in the SS and a key Third Reich functionary. We're going to read now a short section about a proposed Third Reich military mission, which we're going to see several of the names that we've encountered so far cropping up in the same context. Reading now from a book called The Quest for the Red Prince. It was co-authored by two Israeli authors, both of whom with Mossad connections, Michael Bar-Zohar, Bar-Zohar, and Eitan Haber, Haber, published in hardcover by William Morrow & Company, copyright 1983. Now, the operation that's being described here is a proposed diversionary operation from the Battle of the Bulge, basically. Now, the Battle of the Bulge was the last offensive ever undertaken. That's actually the American name for the Ardennes Offensive, the last offensive operation ever undertaken by the Third Reich. This was an attempt, basically, to force the Western Allies to conclude a separate military peace with Germany, after which it was proposed that they would join together and attack the Soviet Union. At any rate, because at this point, this was very late in the war, the Ardennes Offensive actually began in December of 1944. Because of the highly unfavorable numerical situation which the Nazis faced, they were badly outnumbered, it was proposed that a number of diversionary operations be staged to draw off Allied forces from the proposed offensive. One of these diversionary operations was to be basically a Palestinian uprising, an anti-British, recall that Palestine at this time was a British colony, an